Welcome to the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast, where it's all about learning from the best minds in the sport so you can train smarter, stay healthy, and run faster now. And now your host, Tina Muir.
Hello, this is Tina Muir. Welcome to another episode of the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast. You may have noticed that I've been listening to your requests. I've mentioned a few times that guests coming on the show are people I know you want to hear from. And those of you who have been brave enough to reach out to me to share what you were looking for, I've made sure we either get that person or we get someone just as good. And trust me, I'm trying to get some of the big names you keep requesting, but so far no luck. One of the requests that we hear from often is for other coaching philosophies. Another is to hear from elite athletes and kind of what life looks like for them. Today, I was able to do both by interviewing the head coach at Team USA Minnesota. You're going to hear about the life of an elite athlete and what he does to prepare them for their races. So my guest today is Coach Dennis Barker. He is the head coach at Team USA Minnesota since formed in 2001. He's coached Olympians and professionals at distances from 800 to the marathon. This includes 23 US national champions. And he's coached athletes who have qualified for 29 US teams, competing in world championships at cross country, indoor track, outdoor track, and the road. And he also has 72 top three finishes in the US championships. I'm sorry, his athletes do, not him. Today, Dennis and I are going to talk about what life looks like for an elite athlete at Team USA Minnesota, and why he prefers that athletes do have some kind of job or hobby outside of running, the importance of individualizing a training plan to suit each runner's strengths, and why Minnesota is the best place to train. I think you're really going to enjoy this one, and it's going to be very insightful for you. So let's get on with the interview. Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast, Dennis.
It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you on, and I'm looking forward to hearing all the things you have to say. So you are the head coach at Team USA Minnesota. Now, I know what that means, but for those who don't, could you kind of explain what that is all about?
Well, we're a post-collegiate training group, and we were formed to help good collegiate runners kind of bridge the gap between being a good college runner and a professional runner, and try to help some of those with potential making a living at it and qualify for US teams competing internationally.
Okay. And then when you say, you know, a good collegiate, like what kind of level are you talking about here? Just could you give us some kind of ballpark figures for maybe 5K, 10K that people could kind of understand?
Yeah, generally, like for women, for example, in the 5K, we'll look at people from the high 15s to the low 16s. And then in the 10K, probably high 32s, low 33s. And then on the guys' side, we've taken low 29s and anywhere in the 28s. And then for 5K, we've taken people as high as like around 14, 20. And part of it depends a little bit on what we see as their potential, because some athletes maybe didn't run the events that maybe were going to be their best events eventually in college. And so like Matt Gabrielson, for example, you know, his best 5K in college was 14:19, and then he got down to 13:30 when he started training with us and got eighth in the Olympic trials. And then, you know, there's other people that have come in, like when we began, we started with, you know, a big Minnesota name, Carrie Tollefson, and she was able to help us draw some other people in, like Katie McGregor. And they were NCAA champs, both of them.
Okay, so it really depends. And what kind of, you said, you know, it depends on their potential. Do you have some things, just out of curiosity, that you use, like running form or like how much training they've done? Or what things do you use to look at people?
Yeah, I'll look at how much training they've done. Like in Matt's case, you know, in high school, he was a pretty good runner, but he didn't even run that much. He played football and in the fall, and he played baseball as well as track in the spring. And so then when he got to college, he was a pretty low mileage runner, just because he needed to be at that point. So we felt like looking at his progression and the fact that he had a little bit of speed was a good thing because you can gain more endurance. And so, and then, you know, if somebody has a good 800, for example, a lot of college athletes will do things for the team a lot. You know, they might be in the relays, the DMR, they might not be able to shine individually quite as much. So once they get to the professional ranks, they're able to kind of explore their own potential and maybe move up in a distance. And as they gain endurance, you know, we maintain their speed. And then so they're real good at, you know, maybe a 5K, 10K, whereas maybe they were more of a miler, you know, 3K person or even 800 in college.
Yeah. And you've had quite a few people even transition up to the marathon within a few years, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it even goes further than that. So well, when, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and then eventually Matt ran a pretty good marathon, 2:13.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, definitely. And then what about you came up with the idea for Team Minnesota? I'm guessing if you were the kind of founder, like how did you come up with the idea of that, or what gave you the thinking to start that up?
Well, I wasn't the founder. The founder was actually Patricia Goodwin.
Okay.
And she's a local person who had been active in the running community, been on the Twin Cities Marathon Board. She was the one who had the idea and has really done the hard work of setting up a nonprofit organization, which we are. You know, you look at groups around the country and every group has to do what's best for them and how the area they're in provides opportunity for them to thrive. And for us, it was to set up a nonprofit and to have donors get involved. And you know, we don't have a revenue stream like a, you know, like a store or camps or things like that. So that's how it was done. And Patricia did all of the legwork for that. And she talked to me about coaching. And so, you know, she, and I think that if we had, you know, one person doing a lot of things, it would have been hard to sustain. But she handled all the business side of it and the fundraising, and I just do the coaching. And so it works out pretty well. And we've been going since 2001.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's been great. And I've seen, you know, a lot of growth within the athletes themselves. But just briefly, you said about funding. So you rely mostly on donations. Just kind of could you explain the process a little more for us? You know, you aren't kind of like Hanson Brooks as the store, but you said you rely on mostly donors. Could you kind of explain about that a little?
Well, we have some major donors such as Twin Cities in Motion, Houston Marathon, the Pittsburgh Marathon, New York Roadrunners has been very good to us. And then we have Lifetime Fitness and some other in-kind donations around here, Twin Cities Orthopedics. And then we also have individual donors as well. And so we have kind of a major sort of group and then individuals who are in the community filling in. And we have a tremendous running community in the Twin Cities area, and it's been thriving for a lot of years. And so people are really excited to have a group like ours here.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's been awesome to see how, you know, you've thrived being there, you know, especially in Minnesota, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But how did you initially bring on the big names to get it going? Did you know them from when they were in college, or was it kind of built a relationship over time? You mentioned like Carrie and Matt, and how did that kind of come? How did that you get them to come to you?
Well, right when we were starting up, Carrie was coming out of college and kind of looking for a situation. And so we had a high profile athlete right off the bat. And then she talked Katie into coming, and so we were able to pick up some other people, and Janelle Dethridge and some people like that. And then from there, you know, it doesn't matter who you get, what kind of names, you have to have some success. And we did have some success. And right off the bat, you know, Carrie had improved from like 1551 down to 1504. And she won the Olympic trials in the 1500, and Katie was national champion in the 10,000. So then it helped us bring in other people.
Okay. And then do you find now people just kind of reach out to you, or do you still kind of contact athletes coming out of college?
Well, that's a good question, because early in the 2000s, there weren't very many groups. And so people contacted us fairly regularly. We didn't really call anybody, and it was kind of word of mouth, and people would come. And we also had a good source of athletes coming out of the University of Minnesota, some very good ones like Gabriel Grunewald and Heather Kampf, Emily Brown, and so Andrew Carlson, Antonio Vega. So we had, we didn't really have to look. And one of the things that we always wanted to do, and we have a board of directors that always looks at this as well, is to provide an opportunity for Minnesotans, you know, who want to continue on to run. And so really, if you look at, not to take full credit for it or anything, but I think it's part of it, is that as our group has had success, Minnesota high school running is an all-time high, and there's great runners, and there's been good collegiate runners. And it's just, I think all of those things kind of feed into a really good competitive running environment.
Oh, absolutely. I could see that easily. And I'm guessing then you do have a good community relationship, like the athletes do things with the local community in their off time?
Quite a lot, actually, yeah. We do a lot with Twin Cities in Motion, and we've done things with the Heart Association and the schools, junior highs. And then we've done things with the Pittsburgh Marathon with their kids program, and a lot of the organizations that are sponsors for us. We get involved in things that they're involved in and they want us to be involved in. And it works out really well. It's fun.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. Sounds like it. And what about the group overall? Do you have specific goals where you'd like to take it, or how big you would like to get?
We don't want to get real big. You know, our goal is to put people on U.S. teams competing internationally, to win national championships, to make Olympic teams, world teams. And so that's our number one goal. So we never want to be more than maybe 12 or 15. And that's kind of where we've stayed. And we try to balance it out about half and half, men and women. Sometimes it goes one way or the other a little bit, depending on how long people might stay, or if there's an athlete that we want to bring on, and we'll, you know, make an exception to bring somebody on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's kind of talk a little more about the athletes themselves. And I'm sure many of our listeners have absolutely no idea what being an elite athlete involves. So could you just kind of give us a brief overview of, or as in-depth as you want, I guess, of what life is like for a full-time professional athlete, maybe one, you know, on the higher end, and then maybe one on the lower end who works as well?
Yeah, and I would say in our group, it's rare to be a full-time professional athlete. And it's one of the things that we felt like was important. And so we wanted to have people not just be runners, but have an opportunity to have something else in their life, so everything wasn't just wrapped in their up in their running. And not, you know, I always felt like, you know, if I had been good enough, I don't know if I could, you know, go up in the mountains and live up there and just train and play video games or whatever. But we have an accountant on the team, someone with an accounting degree, and she has a part-time job that's flexible for her training and racing with an accounting firm. And then we've had an engineer, we've had people in all kinds of fields. And we try to then, through our board and through our connections within the running community, find jobs for those people that they can get a foot in the door in their field if they would like. And at the same time, be able to train and have flexibility to go to races and so forth. And then there are others that maybe aren't in their field, but we have other places that they've worked, and they pretty much all have a part-time job.
Okay, that's good. And I totally agree with you. And that is why I'm doing this right now, because I couldn't even imagine handling just running. And I think that's when people get into trouble, because, like you said, it becomes your life and you become obsessed with it. And then if you get injured, you know, what then? So I definitely agree with that. So for a typical, if you could describe like a typical male and a typical woman, or either or, what a day would look like for them outside of their work, you know, do most people run twice a day? Do they take naps? Are there, you know, do you have a generic, I know everyone's going to be different depending on what they do, but.
Yeah. A lot of times we do most of our workouts in the morning. It depends a little bit if in the track season, we'll go more in the afternoon or evening because that's when a lot of the track races are. But for the people who are more on the roads, those races are in the morning. And so we want to kind of be more applicable to that. But I really individualize things as well. There's good things about training in a group and bad things. And the good thing is that sometimes people can pull you along to go faster. But a bad thing is sometimes you're not doing what's best for you. You might be in a group and, you know, somebody in the group is getting the right training effect for them, but maybe you aren't. You're going too fast, you're going too slow, whatever. So I try to individualize those things. But having said that, most people train together most of the time. And sometimes when I do take an extra rest day for somebody, because people have different recovery rates, and you know, somebody like Heather, who runs 800s and 1500s, she may be doing some sort of a longer, you know, threshold workout with somebody who's running a marathon. But other days she may be, you know, working out with a separate training partner, doing something shorter. And then, you know, that marathon person might be working with a 5K person. Or so people kind of come in and out of other people's workouts. And sometimes they're all together and sometimes they aren't. But to me, it's important to do the best thing for each athlete every day, because that's how they're going to stay healthy and keep progressing as a professional athlete. So as far as doing twice a day runs, some do, some don't. Some do sometimes, and you know, so it's all over the place, really. It depends on what time of year it is. But generally, a typical week might be where we would meet. Or they would meet at maybe 8 or 8:30 and warm up together. And then there'd be a workout time. And then some might go to work that day for a little bit. Some might go home and take a nap and maybe work a little bit in the evening. Or, you know, there's different kinds of schedules.
Yeah. Do they all live together?
No, early on they did. We actually had a house, and a lot of the women lived together. And then there was a house where the guys lived. But then as the first group of Carrie and Janelle and Katie and some of those, Jason Lempool, began to get a little bit older, they were doing well and they bought houses and maybe got married, and you know, now some of them are having kids. So we have these generations going on, and it's really great to have a lot of alumni in the area, and they're still involved with the team in different capacities. And but it's just nice to have them here, and so we have a good group of sort of grandkids along the way here, houses and marriages and all that.
Yeah, sounds like a great little family you've got there, rather than just, you know, individuals who happen to train together, which is good. And then just as people will be curious, do they have massages? Do you have a nutritionist? Like, are there any other resources that most, you know, average runners wouldn't have access to?
Yeah. I would say the average runner in the Twin Cities has access to a lot. A lot of really good people who work in the running community. And we have access to, you know, an Ultra G, underwater treadmill, in the winter, a big turf field under a big dome where you can run, you know, like almost 300 meters around on turf, and then we have indoor track. We have massage. We do have a nutritionist. We've worked with a sports psychologist. We have three doctors on our board, and they are good sports med doctors. One of them is Bob Kempinen, who is an Olympic marathoner. And so any of the athletes, if they need to see a doctor for anything, whether it's running related or not, all they have to do is call up and go in, and they can get right in. We have a really excellent physical therapist, and everybody on the team has a standing appointment every week, whether they're sore or not or hurt or not, because I think it's a good preventative kind of thing. And so it's good to get a baseline when somebody's healthy, so you can kind of tell when things start to go, if something goes wrong, you know, the physical therapist can tell a difference and so forth. And then we have access to, everybody has a lifetime fitness membership, and we have access to a lot of facilities and machines and all kinds of things there as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, that was a great glimpse into the life. And I love what you said about the physical therapist, because that is so important with, like you said, preventative. And I guess that would mean that, you know, if anyone had, you know, a little pain, had been there more than 2 or 3 days, they could kind of talk about it then, rather than just being typical runners we are and just push it out of our mind until it becomes painful enough. But, you know, with a physical therapist, you may want to share it, which is, that's really good. And I take it, do they do their strength training with the physical therapist, or do you have a group strength training, or how's that work?
It's been different over time, kind of depending on people's schedules. And we've done things where we've done like circuit training after workouts. And then not everybody does weight work, like weight lifting, but it'd be some other kinds of things like exercises and plyos and body weight kinds of things. So that generally it'll be done in smaller groups or outside of the actual workout time.
And then how about you? Like, are you the one that kind of administers that strength training?
You know, I don't as much as maybe some other coaches. I talk with each of the athletes about what their specific needs are, because I don't want to just do strength training because I think people should do strength training, because I don't think so. And I don't think, you know, I'll do something if I think it's going to make them a faster runner, because that's what we're about. I don't care if they're stronger, if it's not going to make them faster or prevent injury. And so you have, you know, somebody like Gabriel Grunewald and Heather Kampf, they have similar PRs, pretty close in the 800 and the 1500, but they're totally different athletes. And Heather does much more strength work and weight work, whereas Gabriel is much lighter. And if she did some of those things, she would get hurt. And so what's best for each athlete is what I look at more than anything.
Yeah, and that's very important, individualizing it rather than, you know, writing a blanket program for people. Mm-hmm. And then what about when you got into coaching? Were you a collegiate coach before you began working for Team USA Minnesota? Or was this something that made you want to coach around 2001? Or what's your history yourself?
I coached for a couple of years when I got out of college. I was a collegiate runner, not a great one, but sort of a journeyman. I coached for a couple of years, men's and women's cross country and track and field at a small junior college up here. And I coached as I was finishing my degree at Iowa State University for the men's team there for a year. And then I was just out of running, out of coaching for a lot of years as I was working and raising a family, but I was a competitive runner in this region. And then I took a coaching job with a small college up here, Division III college, and just kind of started working on theories and things that had worked for me, trying to help them run better, and just discovered a lot of kind of interesting things that sort of came naturally to me a little bit more, and did not come naturally to the athletes that I was coaching. And so I started doing more research and all of that. And then it got to be just something where, you know, I'd have some success here and there with some of these athletes. And then when we started up Team USA Minnesota, I had kind of a record of working with athletes and trying out different things. And I had kind of a philosophy down that was maybe a little bit different from what was going on in the U.S. at that time, but I would call it maybe a little more old school, but revised.
Could you kind of expand on that a little, just as I'm sure listeners are curious as to, you know, what was different or what your philosophy is?
Right. Well, I was really fortunate to go to two colleges. I went to a small junior college where I was exposed to really high mileage. And it was all Lydiard type of work. and we hardly did anything faster than 5 minute per mile pace, but we did a ton of it. And then after 2 years, I went to Iowa State University, and it was exactly the opposite. It was much more mileage and more intense. And so as I got out, I sort of took things from each of those that worked for me, and I kind of discarded some of the other things. And then, so that's kind of the old school part. And then as I read some of the other things, like, you know, about lactate threshold, and some physiologists from Denmark and from Norway who had worked with skiers, and, you know, Peter Koh and David Martin's book, I started adopting kind of a modified Lydiard / Koh program, where, you know, and I still basically have two tenets that are really important in training. And one is, I want to increase the amount of time that people spend in a high quality aerobic area. And I want to use a multi-pace approach, which means that I use all of the paces and all of the tools all year long, but the percentages just change depending on the time of year and what races are coming up, or if there's no races or things like that. But even if you're in a heavy strength and endurance phase, there's always a little bit of speed. You're never like detraining any part of what you're going to need or one of your tools.
Okay, interesting. That was really interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. And so it sounds like, based on your opinion, if someone's out there and they're kind of thinking that they would like to get into coaching, a lot of it is going to be, you know, what you read about, what you've kind of learned yourself, and kind of creating your own program based on what you have experienced that has worked, or other people have had experience, and just kind of creating your own, you know, plan based on that, rather than just, you know, trusting that one style is significantly better than others.
Coaching education is pretty interesting, because there are a lot of coaches that were good runners, and they begin coaching by just sort of pulling out things that they did. They're like, hey, it worked for me, I'm going to do this. And they start having people do that, and they discover that that's not the case, that there are a lot of different kinds of people. And then they have to adjust and try to learn, you know, new things. And also, you know, there's coaching education programs, which are very good. You know, there's physiology classes, there's all of that. But I think the most important thing, you know, and you learn a lot of technical things, you know, about physiology and chemistry, for example, in those types of settings. But there's no substitute for experience. And I feel like, and I see it all the time, actually, you know, there's some pretty good young coaches out there, but they really don't have experience. And you know, I can have an athlete come to me, and I have years of experience working with a lot of different kinds of athletes, men and women, 800 people all the way up to the marathon, different kinds of people that did the same event, but they got there different ways. I've had people who were very low mileage runners that had success because they had to, you know, they couldn't do higher mileage because they would get injured. And so I had to learn what worked best for them and how to get the most out of them on that kind of mileage. And there were other people that ran very high mileage. And so I've used lots of different kinds of things. And so if somebody comes to me and asks about what's best for them, you know, right away I'm kind of thinking back in my experience, and I'm thinking, well, you know, what type of athlete is this, and what kinds of things? And I don't coach in a authoritarian way. I coach in a cooperative way, because for me, it's really important to get feedback from the athletes, because it's that feedback that helps me make good decisions. And if I'm not getting feedback, then I can make bad decisions and they might get injured or run poorly. And so it has to be a cooperative kind of thing where they're learning about themselves and they're kind of stretching. And then, you know, they may have goals and we talk about those, and I'll say, you know, based on experience, I'll say, well, this might be good or this might be good. And then it might be something they had never thought of before. And so we kind of work it out, and then, you know, they need to trust some things, and that's how we work.
Yeah. And in your opinion, would you say that, you know, this isn't just for elite runners? Would you say most people would benefit from, you know, meeting a coach and, you know, obviously one you finding one you can trust, but having some outside perspective to look in and kind of assess what works for you and what based on the kind of person you are?
I'd say yes and no. Yes, because I think that I work also with a very small number of non-elite athletes, and they're just people starting out and they just don't know much about running. And it's a shortcut for them, I guess. They don't have to do all the research and do all this. They can just have me tell them. And then usually when I explain something, they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And they trust in it and they can do it. And knowing that, I feel like the running media right now is kind of like telling people everything, you know, this is what you do for, shoes, and you have to listen to earphones and you have to drink this much and you have to tell you. And people kind of maybe lose. And I come from a background where there wasn't any of that stuff. And we just went out and ran, and you had the joy of just being out there in the woods or in the country without listening to anything and without thinking about your heart rate or your hydration or your, you know, anything like that. You're just running and how you feel. And that has value as well.
Yeah. Too complicated. That's actually, I've seen a few posts, not from running websites, but recently about how we, you know, we're now relying on technology and other things to tell us when all we need to really do is actually just listen to what our body is telling us, or actually, you know, keep it simple. And that's my fiance who coaches, he actually as well, he believes in keep it simple and, you know, don't worry about all the heart rate and, like you said, you know, specific, you need exactly 4 ounces of water or whatever it is. So
you can drive you nuts. If you need a watch to tell you when to stand up, I mean,
yeah, very true. So I want to kind of ask you a bit more, as I'm sure people are wondering about this, but why Minnesota? This may have just been from where you live, but do you want to kind of explain why it ended up being Minnesota?
Because this is where I live.
Okay. Simple answer there. And so kind of tell us a little about the winters, how you get through those, like how you, I guess people do a lot of runs on treadmills. Is the weather as bad as we think it is, or?
Well, define bad, I guess. But if you look back at running in Minnesota, it's really great. I mean, we've had a lot of Olympians, like in the marathon and the 10,000 meters, from Janice Klecker to Bob Kempinen to Steve Placentia to Gary Bjorklund to Van Nelson to Ron Dawes to Buddy Edelin. Tons of distance runners who have been on the Olympic team, and a lot of them trained here. And it kind of makes you a little bit tougher. And, you know, I think that the winter is not a natural disadvantage. I think it's a natural advantage, because sometimes it makes you kind of run slower. And you can't, you know, if you're in ideal conditions all the time, you're just training, and you don't get the mental break or the physical break. And so I think here you have a tendency to be a little bit more aerobic oriented maybe than some other places. Like I said, there's an enormous running community up here. And one of the things they really did well when they set up the city, there's a ton of lakes and there's a big river that goes through it. And all of them have public space around them. Houses aren't right up to them. And all of them have running paths around them. And when it snows, right away early in the morning, like 6 a.m., they come out and plow the running paths. And so people are out there all the time running. And yeah, there are treadmills, and sometimes they're fine, especially if it's icy. And we do have access to really nice ones on Woodways at Lifetime Fitness and, you know, Zero Runners and things like that. But it's also not so bad.
No, I actually agree with you there. I went to school in Michigan, and for the 5 years I know what you're saying about making you tough. I could not agree more. And it, you know, it does make you think that when you go to those races, especially as a college runner in cross country, I remember we 3 out of my 4 national championships were snow. It was snow on the ground, and each time, you know, if you've been through that, you know what it's like, and you know you get on with it. Or even if it's hot, you know, you've been through worse, so you get on with it. Whereas, yeah, if you live in perfect conditions, you become a bit soft. And also the same with Michigan is, you know, they're very good at plowing, like you mentioned. You know, if they're good at plowing, then you don't really have such an issue. But like, I'm in Kentucky now, and when it snows, I'm kind of locked in for 5 days until they get it plowed. So yeah, I can see what you're saying there. And then, so do you have some areas that, you know, are always clear to work out? Like, they're very good. I mean, you said about the running paths. Are those the best places for workouts when the weather is bad? Or do you tend to turn to the treadmills when it is icy?
Well, if it's icy or we have a snowstorm, then you have to go either on the indoor turf, which is pretty easy on your legs, and you can do, you know, a fair amount of volume on there, because it's a good turf field, it's soft, or the indoor track or the treadmill.
Okay, so you have a few options.
Yeah.
And then just, do you have some thoughts on treadmills themselves? You know, some people say they're easier, some people say they're more difficult. Do you have any thoughts on, based on what you've seen with your athletes?
Maybe it's easier physically, but it's harder mentally to be on a treadmill. I do feel, though, that, and I've used them very successfully with people training for a marathon, because I think it's actually pretty good marathon training because it's so monotonous. And you are running the same pace, the same rhythm for a long time. And so when, you know, Sarah Wells was on our team and she won the U.S. Marathon Championship in the spring, and did all of her harder stuff on the treadmill. And we simulated the course by putting in hills whenever there was a hill on the course. She was able to have her drinks right there and take them every 15 minutes and get used to that. And at the same time, she was able to heat train. And so the times that we've used the treadmills for marathoners, and Antonio Vega, actually, you know, he won the U.S. half marathon in 101 something. And did for leading up to that for a couple of months. We had a little stretch of weather, and he had slipped on the ice the year before, and he just didn't want to take the chance. So he did all of his stuff on the treadmill, and then went on and won the half marathon.
Yeah, we actually, I will put that on the show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC69. We did actually have him on the podcast a few years ago after that, talking about that experience. So people can go check that out. And then how do you keep people motivated during those moments, like Anthony, or what do you tell them to kind of stay mentally on their game rather than, you know, it's kind of tough, like you said, mentally to stay focused?
You know, I don't see it as a big function of mine to motivate them. I feel like a professional athlete, if you're going to aspire to be a professional athlete, you have to have that inside of you, and you have to be driven yourself, because I can't really put that in there. And it actually, I actually don't like it if I feel like somebody doesn't have that as much, because the worst feeling there is for a coach is to feel like you're putting in more than the athlete, because they're never going to reach their full potential. Mm-hmm. So I think that the athletes that are driven and they have a vision, their long range plan, and they're on the treadmill and they're not, you know, thinking about how bad it is and how sweaty they are. They're thinking about their next race and you know, they're getting into that and they're visualizing that and they're working on the treadmill thinking about that. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those principles can be applied to other runners too. You know, if you are on treadmill, you can think about your future upcoming race. So one more kind of topic I wanted to just go over for a few minutes was about what your thoughts on the future of distance running. I know this year, or 2016 qualifier, especially for the marathon, has kind of skyrocketed. There's so many women climbing up that chart, and even a lot of men on that list. Do you kind of see things to keep moving forward, or what are your thoughts on the future of American distance running?
Well, it's really good right now. I mean, in all of the events, they're very, very competitive. And in one way, it's pretty gratifying because when we started in 2001, one of the reasons was American distance running was so bad on an international level. And, you know, the Hansons had started their group and we started ours then the same time that at that time it was Team USA California, but now it's the Mammoth Track Club. And then I think it was right after that, maybe Oregon Project. But at that time, the reason the Hansons did it and then the reasons we did it and the others were to try to improve U.S. distance running. And the New York Roadrunners under Mary Wittenberg got into it big time and I think had a huge influence on improving U.S. distance running by putting on races and really bringing Americans out there. They put on a lot of races and brought people in, and they supported all of the training groups financially. And so that was a real kickstart for the whole thing because not all of the groups had, you know, the financial backing and all of that to really do what they wanted to do. So gradually then there have become more groups. And I think that in addition to, you know, like high school athletes, you know, and when we started in 2001, a lot of the stars now were high school athletes. And so, you know, they could look up and they could see, hey, there's professional running in their support in the U.S. And that's what I want to do. I want to be a professional runner. And they might not have looked at our group in particular, whether it was they were looking at, you know, something like Brian Sell or whoever they were looking at. I think that they aspired to be professional runners. And more that has occurred. And I think even in Minnesota, the high school athletes, you know, see our group and see the other groups, and they're all on the internet now, and you can just see there's this whole group of professional athletes out there competing, and there's a lot more options for groups and where to train. There's a lot more, well, there's support in the groups, but actually maybe less from the shoe companies for some reason. We, you know, it's a tougher thing. They don't seem to be doing quite as much as far as sponsorship goes.
Yeah. And
so I think that that has been very successful, starting the groups, and you know, we have been a part of it. And you know, the Hansons are a big part of it, and the New York Roadrunners, and you know, other groups.
So yeah, that's been a good summary, and I like thinking about how, you know, you guys have kind of pushed it in the right direction, and love the idea about high school athletes coming into it. And I think also you kind of got me thinking about how it's also because with the internet now, you can kind of progress, you can see how people have progressed. Like in the past, you may have known someone from your town and seen them on the Olympics or whatever, but now you can kind of, you can pick an athlete and say, oh, what did they run in high school? And then you can look it up. So yeah, it's easier to be motivated by that. And, you know, groups like you are huge in that.
Yeah. And the high school, you know, and I think the future is really bright for American distance running. You look in the rest of the world and, you know, we're right up there. Not always with the Kenyans or Ethiopians, but more and more. And for every notch higher that you have to get, it takes longer and it takes more people getting up there. And we do have more and more people trying to get up there, so we're going to have more that make it. And that's the important thing. But looking at just high school running in Minnesota, which I'm familiar with, it's never been better. I mean, we have the state meet this year was incredible. You know, we had a 206 high school junior on the girls' side. And we've had, you know, a bunch of milers and 2 milers under 9 minutes and just really great athletes coming out of high school right now.
Very exciting for the future. And just, this is not on the questions I had, but as you got me curious about it, do all your athletes have individual sponsors, or, I mean, maybe some of them don't, as you mentioned, but it's not like everyone is sponsored by the same kind of, you know, Hanson Brooks has Brooks, but everyone has their kind of own person.
We made an intentional decision not to try to get one shoe company to sponsor us, because early on, all of the athletes were able to get individual sponsorships that were better for them individually than just one blanket one where everybody was kind of under the same thing. And so if you started to really excel, you might not be able to get what your true earning power was. And so, you know, Carrie was with Adidas and Katie was at one point. And then we've had people with every single company over the years. And so I think that is part of the reason why athletes then were able to make a good living and, you know, buy their own house and stay here and have a career and so forth.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions and kind of things I wanted to ask you about today. I just have one more question, which I ask each guest who comes on the show, which is, if you could give me one word to describe what you would like to become, accomplish, or achieve this year, what would it be and why?
Epic.
Epic? That's a good one. any expansion on that, or just you want the life to be epic?
Well, you read about the purpose-driven life, but I want to live the epic life.
Okay, go for it. We'll support you in that. Okay, Dennis, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. If people want to reach out to you, the best option for them would probably be to go to your website.
Yes.
Okay.
It's very nice to talk with you as well. And the website is Dennis Barker, coachbarker.com.
Okay, easy to find. And I will also put a link to that on the show notes. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
What a knowledgeable guy. Wasn't that interesting? I know I enjoyed it a lot. I'm hoping you did too. The topics from today's episode, as well as a link to his information-packed website, can be found at runnersconnect.net/RC69. Hopefully you are enjoying these podcasts, but as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, if you do have a guest that you would like to hear from or a topic that you would like me to cover, please feel free to email me Tina@runnersconnect.net. And also, if you go to the show notes, there is actually a way you can leave a voice message on the right-hand side of the page. So then you can leave me a message rather than sending an email. Well, that's all from me this week. I look forward to talking to you soon.